Now, if you can have your Bibles open at that passage Margaret read, that would be really great, as we're going to focus on those verses this morning. Now, if some of you may have read Arthur Hailey's book Wheels, it's a best-selling novel which takes the lid off the car assembly plant line in Detroit. And it warns you never to buy a car that was made on a Friday or a Monday, or it will probably need a new gearbox or a clutch within 3 months. It highlights one of the problems of our modern world: how difficult it is to have quality and quantity at the same time. Because these two seem to relate to each other in inverse proportion. The more quantity you have, the less quality you have. For example, a mass-produced item rarely seems to have as much lifespan as one that's handmade, does it? And so, likewise, it is in relationship to the Christian church. The more quantity you get, the less quality you're likely to have. And Jesus himself knew this. And at this stage of his ministry that we're reading about this morning, he was attracting huge crowds. He was getting a mass following. Verse 25 says, large crowds were traveling with him. And Jesus didn't let this go to his head, because he was not one of those who necessarily saw that as the indicator of success. In fact, he knew that though the size of the crowds meant that his following had increased in quantity, the quality had gone right down. And this very often tends to be a problem when you get a large church to maintain the quality of the discipleship amid so many people. And Jesus can do far more with quality disciples than quantity disciples. He can do far more with a few who are prepared to go all the way than with a crowd of followers who are perhaps not all really serious, and who may be like that great crowd in Jesus' day, who were following him for what they could get out of him. They had high hopes that Jesus was on his way to Jerusalem to set them all free from the Romans, to give them freedom, to give them joy, to give them whatever they wanted. And so they were following him in droves for the benefits which they perceived would come. And Jesus turned round and he said something to them, calculated, I think, actually to send most of them packing. Because he would rather have one person coming to him who had counted the cost, someone who means real business and is prepared to go all the way, than to have a great crowd coming for what is possibly essentially superficial and selfish reasons. And so the theme this morning is the cost of being a disciple. And you know, time and time again, Jesus lost a convert by warning them what the Christian life could mean. Because the tragedy is that if you don't count the cost of being a Christian to begin with, you will travel so far, and then as soon as the quality requirements come in, you'll stop. And at that point, you're going to be in a worse condition, really, than when you started. So we're going to look first at being at the cost of being a disciple. Then secondly, at counting the cost, how you go about it. And then thirdly, at the reason for counting the cost. Let's take the first, the cost of being a disciple. And in verse 26, Jesus mentions two things that hurt very deeply and probably cause many of us to want to argue with Jesus and say he is being unreasonable. Here's the first. Whoever does not hate his father and mother, his wife and children, his brothers and sisters, cannot be my disciple. Now let me say straight away that the meaning of that word hate was not quite the same in their day as it is in ours. Today it's an emotional word and it means having malice in your heart. A desire in your heart to hurt somebody, to offend them, to insult them, that sort of thing. Now that actually is not what hate in the Bible means. It's another example really of how we take something that can be right and make it horrible by our own perverted emotions. Take anger for example. Anger is actually an amoral emotion. It can be right or wrong. And in Paul's letter to the Ephesians, Paul writes at one point, he says, "In your anger, do not sin." Which means that it is not always wrong to be angry, if it's the right type of anger. But these days we always tend to think of the emotion of anger as being wrong. And yet Jesus got angry at times. He turned a whip on the money changers in the temple. And yet Jesus never sinned. And it's much the same with this word hate, which is used here in verse 26. Now don't get me wrong, the Bible says that your family is a holy thing and that your relationships within that family are meant to be kept intact in God's sight. But what this text is saying is this. If ever the claims of Christ and the claims of your nearest and dearest conflict, then there is no question as to what a disciple of Jesus must do. They have to love Christ in preference to their nearest and dearest, which is what the Bible means here by this word hate. Because you see, sometimes those who are nearest and dearest to you can be your greatest opponents in your spiritual life. And one of the tragedies of this world is that when God's grace comes into your life, it can divide your family. It really can. It can create divided loyalties and affections. But for the true disciple of Christ, there is no choice. That is part of the cost of being a disciple. And the nearest and dearest relationship to you may have to be sacrificed if you're to stay faithful to Christ. Notice I say may. It doesn't follow that you've got to cut all your links. It's when the claims conflict. Jesus has to take the top priority. The second part of the cost is even more frightening in a sense. Jesus has been talking about your nearest and dearest. But now he goes on to say the second condition is to hate yourself as well. In other words, to crucify your own human desires in preference to Christ's. And in our day and age, the pressure is on us to be fulfilled, to get happiness, to choose a career which will draw out the best from us, to indulge ourselves. And we are all after satisfying self. And Jesus says, following him, genuine discipleship, will involve a cross, not a cushion. And the hardest thing, I think the hardest thing about Christianity is the part of dying to yourself. And Jesus gave these two conditions to discipleship, to this huge crowd. Can you see that there is a big difference between being in a crowd and listening to Jesus and becoming one of his disciples? There's a huge difference. How many disciples of Jesus are there in this congregation? It doesn't follow necessarily that because you're here in church listening to the words of Jesus, that makes you one of his followers. You may just be one of a crowd. And Jesus may well be challenging you now and saying, these are the conditions if you want to be one of my disciples, not just a hanger-on. But then Jesus moves on to the second fact. And he says, I want you to sit down and count the cost before you commit yourself to me. It is very easy to get carried along by a crowd without asking, first of all, what is it going to cost? And the time to count is beforehand, not afterwards. It is a bit like marriage, I guess. I mean, you wouldn't rush into that, would you? In fact, in the marriage service, the preamble, the introduction says, in most forms of Christian marriage service, that marriage is not to be entered into lightly, unadvisedly, or thoughtlessly, but with due reverence and fear of God. Because it's a very big choice to make. And Jesus uses a lovely picture to get this point across. He says, take a building. If you're on a building project, it is downright irresponsible to say, fine, let's go ahead and build. The Lord will provide. You sit down and you count the cost before you start building. And then he changes the picture again and he says, what person going into battle doesn't carefully weigh it up? And the life of a Christian is on the one hand like a building, and on the other hand it's like a battle. It is hard work and it is a conflict. It's not a picnic or a jamboree. As somebody once put it, salvation is free, but it's not cheap. The entrance fee is nothing, but the annual subscription is everything. Now, when Jesus speaks of giving up everything in verse 33, he says, any of you who does not give up everything he has cannot be my disciple. Does that mean that I've got to go back home and give away all my assets, my house, all that I own, and leave my family, chuck in my job, and get rid of it all? Some weird sects have actually taken those words very literally. But is that what it means? I think the real meaning of what Jesus is saying here is illustrated by a man I heard about some while ago who sat down and he made a list of everything he possessed, which amounted to several large sheets. And then he got on his knees And he gave them to the Lord one by one. And then at the end he said, "Now, Lord, tell me which of these things can I keep?" And he finished up with about two-thirds of the original list. But in actual fact, he ended up with nothing. Can you see that? He had given everything and only kept what the Lord allowed him to keep. And that's what Jesus is meaning here, I believe. But he thirdly speaks not only of how you count the cost, but why you should count the cost. And the answer is he wants disciples of quality, not quantity. And he uses now another word picture which gets across this point. He wants salty Christians. The more costly your Christianity, the better the quality tends to be. Costliness and the quality of your Christian discipleship will go together. If you're living a nice, easy, comfortable Christian life, it's quite possible that the quality will be quite poor. But if it has cost you something, and I'm sure, in fact I know with some of you, you have paid quite heavily for following Christ. That will have produced quality. But if my discipleship hasn't been costly in some shape or form, then the likelihood is that it's of little quality, and I'm like the salt that has ceased to be salty. How does salt lose its saltiness? Well, salt in the Middle East used to be scraped up from the shores of the Dead Sea. And if you scraped up too much sand with the salt, it lost its flavor. And a crooked dealer would very often do that. He would sell by weight, and a good proportion of it would be sand. And when salt is adulterated with something else, it loses its taste and its effect. So you can lose your saltiness, really from the very beginning, by bringing too many other things in with the salt. And also, secondly, if the salt is left exposed to the elements and it's not covered, in the course of time, the rain will wash through the salt, taking the saltiness away and leaving you only with the gritty part. And these are the two ways in which Christians can lose their distinctive quality. It's the two ways in which your discipleship can be undermined. One is that when we come to Christ in the first place, we can bring too many other things with us. Too much of our old life. And the result is that the salt gets adulterated, and it then loses its taste. And the other way is that if your spiritual life is not nurtured and protected and kept carefully, then the storms of life will wash away the saltiness. It will be leached. And either way, if you've lost your saltiness, you are no longer useful for the purpose that God intended you for. And you end up discarded and put on one side as useless. You see, the uses that are mentioned for salt in this passage, in verse 35, are not so much to preserve or even as a flavoring agent in food, which is what we tend to use salt for today. Those weren't the two primary uses in Middle Eastern times when Jesus lived. They had more basic uses for salt in those times. Salt was used mainly as a fertilizer and as a disinfectant. The potash content of salt, which comes from the Dead Sea, made it an excellent fertilizer in the Middle East. And at the same time, because they didn't have flush toilets in those days, just the equivalent of what in Africa we'd call a long drop, you would put handfuls of salt on the site to serve as a disinfectant. Now those two together give you a negative and a positive use of salt. It promoted the growth of good things that you wanted to grow, and it inhibited the spread of bad things that you didn't want to grow. So it's actually a very vivid picture that Jesus uses here. And Christians are to be salt of the earth in both of those senses. And you know the thing about salt is that you don't need a vast amount of it to achieve results. You don't put masses of salt on your meal when you eat, do you? At least I hope you don't. It's bad for your cholesterol. Because all you need is a tiny amount to flavor your food. But what's important is the quality rather than the quantity. And you know, research has shown that we only need 5% of the population to be Christian to influence social trends in this country for the better and to be taken notice of in government legislation. 5%. But again, it's the quality of that 5% that counts. Because Jesus said that if the salt loses its savor, then all it will do is produce contempt in people. People will treat it with disgust. And that's what's happening in Britain today. The real trouble in England is not just that we don't have enough salt, but that the salt that we do have is losing its saltiness. Its quality has become corrupted. And the church's image is now so tarnished that the world despises us. And Christians will only influence the world if they are sufficiently different from it. The world would respect us if we were different, even if they didn't like us. And we should be leading society into a better way, not adopting their standards and values 20 years after them. Now, this could all be very depressing if we think only of quality. We feel helpless or if we're thinking only of quantity. But whilst we might be feeling helpless to increase the quantity of Christians in this country, I'll tell you what we can do. We can increase the quality of Christians in this country. Because you can begin with yourself. There will be a cost involved. And Jesus has spelt it out in this passage. But if you're prepared to pay the price for quality, I believe that God will make up the shortfall in quantity. Simply because more people will come to their faith of Jesus when they see Christian lives being lived as they should be lived. So there's a challenge from Jesus for each one of us this morning. We can begin to change society for the better if we'll take the quality of the Christian life seriously. And that will be a quality that stands out as being different from the rest of society. And that's costly. But God's looking for Christians who are willing to pay the price. Will you be one of them? Let's bow our heads and pray.